unless you're ready, it may not be the right time. Sometimes dependent origination is very profound in the way it is described in the suttas and the way the Buddha taught it. He said this is very, very profound. But at the same time, the general principle of dependent origination is not impossible to understand, I think. I think it's possible to get your mind around how the general principle works without sort of being swamped by all the details and all the complications that can be involved. And that's what I want to do tonight. I want to give you some idea of the general principle without going into all the details, which can make it very complicated and very hard to understand. First of all, is there anybody here who has never heard of dependent origination before? Knows anything about it whatsoever? Everybody has heard about it? Oh, one over there. Okay, so I'm just going to go very briefly then, just to say what it actually looks like, what it looks like in the suttas. And what it looks like in the suttas is a chain of 12 things, one coming after the other. And this chain is a chain of causality. So one thing causes the next one, which causes the next one, which causes the next one, up until the 12th link. So one factor after another causing each other. And if you have the first factor, the second factor must happen. Impossible that it cannot happen. If you have the second factor, the third factor must happen, etc. And basically all the way up through all the links. And if you don't have the first factor, the second factor cannot happen. If you don't have the second factor, the third factor cannot happen. So it is a chain of causality, whereby one factor leads to the next one, or whereby the absence of one factor causes the one after also to disappear. So that is, in essence, the dependent origination. It's all about causality. And to understand this causality, the way I like to talk about this is to focus on the two endpoints of this chain. So first of all, look at the last endpoint. When you look at the last endpoint, the 12th factor of dependent origination, you understand where this whole thing is heading, what the purpose of dependent origination is. Because if one thing causes another throughout the chain, if you find out where it's all heading, the last one, the last thing which is being caused, then you understand what this dependent origination is pointing at, because this is the last thing, right? So what is the last point of dependent origination? It is suffering. Dukkha in Pali, that's the last point. So, dependent origination is a sequence that ends with suffering. And because it is a causal sequence that ends with suffering, it is a sequence that shows you how suffering comes to be in the world. Isn't that wonderful? You can find out how suffering comes to be. Because if you know how suffering comes to be, then you can do something about it. Because if you know the cause of something, you can take away the cause, then you eliminate the result. So this is the point of the Buddha's teaching. He shows causality, in particular in dependent origination. And the causality here is about the causality of suffering. So this is very, you may say, reminiscent of the Second Noble Truth, right? The Second Noble Truth says that craving is the cause of suffering, or the condition for suffering. Yeah? So what is the difference then between dependent origination and the Second Noble Truth? Any guesses? No. I'm going to talk. I'm just saying these things to make you think a little bit, not really to make you answer. The difference is actually there are just two different ways of viewing the same thing. And there are places in the suttas where dependent origination is put into place of craving to show how suffering arises. So there are places where you see this whole sequence of 12 factors, or 11 factors rather, leading up to suffering in place of craving. So there are two different ways of looking at the same thing. But dependent origination is more profound, it shows the thing in more detail, and because it shows the thing in more detail, it's easier to understand how this thing unravels and how it comes to an end. So, very useful chain, it shows you how suffering comes to an end. I've never met anybody who doesn't want to make an end of suffering, at least in theory, until they hear about the path and they have second thoughts sometime, but at least in theory they want to have suffering end. And so it's very useful. So what is this suffering then that we want to make end? Now this suffering is twofold. the first fall, actually it's manifold probably, but one way of looking at that suffering is of course all the sufferings that we have in daily life. To count up all the sufferings you have in daily life. Sometimes you don't even know the sufferings you have because you haven't looked careful enough. But all those sufferings in daily life are included in what we call the noble truth of suffering. In other words, the suffering that we experience as humans or even as animals or any other type of beings. But it's more profound than that. There's more to suffering than just the suffering in ordinary life. If it was just the suffering in ordinary life, then it would be manageable. We might just be able to handle it, at least sometimes. But if it is something more profound, then the thing becomes much more interesting. And this is the thing about Buddhism. There's another aspect to suffering here. And this is the suffering that relates to rebirth in particular. The idea of rebirth. And this is not an easy idea to understand fully. But if you can get your head around what rebirth actually implies, if you think about rebirth, coming back again and again from life to life, now this life, now that life, if you reflect on that a little bit, after a while you start to think, maybe I had enough of this, maybe there is no point to this. And the interesting thing is that if you read the way the Buddha achieved his own awakening, and this is a very important point to my mind, he always remembered his past lives before he attained his full awakening. Isn't that interesting? Why do you think that is? And I say the reason why the Buddha did that is precisely because that was the motivation that he was required to have to actually attain full awakening. He had to see the reality of the problem. And only when he saw the reality of the problem was he able to gain this very profound state that we call awakening. Because awakening is so radical. It's so different from the way we're used to looking at the world. It takes a special kind of motivation inside of you to drive you to reach that state of awakening. And that is seeing the extent of the problem. And that extent of the problem you see when you understand the idea of rebirth. So it is very worthwhile reflecting on this, getting some idea of this. I say you cannot get the full understanding until you see it for yourself, but at least you get a glimpse of these things. If you're able to accept the idea of rebirth, it gives you some sense that there is a problem out there. But it's even more than that, actually. These are two very important aspects of suffering. But it's actually even more profound. And this is the most profound way that suffering is described is in the First Noble Truth. Now, if you remind yourself of the First Noble Truth, it says, jati piduka, birth is suffering. Jara piduka, old age is suffering. Maranam piduka, I'm probably going to get this wrong now, but death is suffering. Being dissociated from what one likes is suffering. Being associated from what one doesn't like is suffering. And finally, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. And this is very profound. The five aggregates of clinging are suffering basically means, and this is what is so profound about it, that everything is suffering here. Everything is suffering. There's no such thing. There's nothing that isn't suffering in the end. And that is very, very difficult to see. In fact, it is so hard to see that you can never really understand that. You cannot just sit down and sort of count all the sufferings in life, and you can probably make a very long list of all the sufferings, but you can never understand what suffering actually means just by counting the sufferings in life. You cannot do that. The only way you can understand suffering is through insight, through understanding it by seeing directly that absolutely everything in existence in the end is suffering. So that is it's very, very profound, and I think because we're dealing with dependent origination, we have to look at these things from this profound aspect, otherwise it doesn't really make sense. So all I'm saying, really consider this, because this is what the Buddha said. You may not understand it. Basically very, very few people can understand these things, except if you have very profound meditation yourself, because it is a matter of insight to understand these things. Suffering can only really be understood through insight. So then consider one of the other factors here, which says, I just want to do this as a slight diversion because it is an interesting thing just to consider. Now one of the other factors of the First Noble Truth is that jati piduka, birth is suffering, right? I mean, we can sort of understand why old age is suffering. It's not that difficult to understand. You become decrepit, you can't walk properly anymore, you can't see properly, you can't hear anything, you can't taste your food properly. Everything starts to collapse when you become old, particularly towards the very end of your life. And of course, that's very unpleasant for most people. You are you have some attachment to our bodies there. So it's difficult to accept old age, basically. Death is suffering. Again, very obvious why that must be so. Death is suffering because you are taken away from all your loved ones, you are taken away from all your friends, all your possession. Everything has to go. Even your body has to go. So again, it's obviously a difficult time. On top of that, you're going to an uncertain destination, which adds another aspect of uncertainty. So death obviously is suffering. But what about birth? Why does the Buddha say birth is suffering here? That isn't so obvious, is it? The first thing to understand about birth in the First Noble Truth is that it actually refers to rebirth. It doesn't just mean birth, it actually means rebirth. And to see that, it's actually quite simple to see that, because the Third Noble Truth is about ending suffering here. Now, and the Fourth Noble Truth is a path to the end of suffering, right? You cannot, if birth is suffering, you cannot end the birth that already has happened. You can only end future births. So, when we say birth is suffering because our purpose is to eliminate all these sufferings, it must refer to future birth that we're eliminating. So, jati here means rebirth in the First Noble Truth. Very important point. But, that's only point number one. But why is it so much suffering? And, of course, maybe the physical aspect of being born, you know, being in a nice and safe place beforehand, everything is nice and warm and cozy here, and then being born into the world, maybe there's lots of pain on the path as well. And of course, that is probably part of the aspect of birth is suffering. But there must be something more than that, more than just, you know, the physical aspects, because that wouldn't be so bad. And I think part of the reason why birth is suffering here, and that is in particular very early on, you can imagine yourself at death. They always say when you die, when you let go of the body, particularly if you have a very bad body with Alzheimer and lots of pains and things like that, and you let go of the body, it's such a beautiful experience, people say here. You get free of this terrible heavy thing, this heavy burden that we carry with us all the time, and for the first time in your life you're free of that, and it feels so light and so easy. It's like getting into a deep meditation state, right? That is what death is like for most people when they experience it. It's a beautiful experience. And imagine yourself, being born is actually the reverse experience of death. Rather than getting rid of the body, you're finally rid of the body, and then you see, oh no, I'm going into a new one, right? So you're finally rid of all this pain, and now you get moved into a new body. And that, I think, is the main reason why birth is suffering. You can see that your mind is moving towards, at the beginning, is this tiny, tiny embryo, you know, can't see, you can't hear anything. You're trapped inside this little thing, with your mind inside this little thing, which can't do anything. You can't think for yourself, you're completely at the mercy of this tiny little thing. You get squeezed in there, your mind gets squeezed in there, and there's nothing really you can do about it. And you can see this just as you're about to get reborn. You can see the trajectory. You're moving in the direction. And because the karma is so strong, there's nothing you can do to hinder that. That is suffering, I think, is the main reason, or at least one main reason, why rebirth is suffering. It's like being born as an animal. You can imagine being born as an animal. An animal has like a small brain, right? Not very wise, not very intelligent. And you can imagine yourself, you are about to be reborn into an animal body. And your mind is going to be constrained by that animal body. The mind is expressed, the mind we have is expressed through our brain, right? So our brain constrains the mind to a certain extent. If you get reborn into an animal, your mind is constrained by the brain. Now, if you get reborn into a tiny embryo, it's much worse than that. So that is just some reasons why I think birth is considered suffering, essentially. It's a little bit of an aside, but I always find these things interesting to contemplate. Why did the Buddha speak in this particular way? So there is a problem out there. Five aggregates are suffering. Because the five aggregates are suffering, because everything is suffering, because rebirth is suffering, because it's a big problem out there, we have to find a solution to this problem. We have to search for a solution. And sometimes people just have enough suffering in their life to understand that they need to search for a solution. Or they are particularly wise people who have an understanding that there is a problem in life and they want to search for a solution. So what then is a solution to suffering? And the Buddha said that the cause of suffering, the cause of old age and death and suffering, is birth. This is what he says in dependent origination. Birth is the cause of suffering here, right? So, if he then says that to eliminate suffering, you have to eliminate the cause of suffering, it means that you have to eliminate birth. That's the only way you can eliminate the cause of suffering here. So if you eliminate birth, what does that mean? If you eliminate birth, it means that you don't get reborn. It means you don't exist anymore. You are ending existence. So the Buddha is saying that the only way to overcome rebirth, overcome suffering, is to end existence. That's what he's saying here. That is the consequence of ending rebirth. So that is then the profundity of the Buddha's teachings. It says, ultimately, by ending birth, you end existence, and in that way, you're ending suffering here. Very, very profound, but it is important, I think, to understand these things. So that is the end of dependent origination. It shows you the problem that we are facing, and it shows you the immediate cause for that problem. Birth leads to suffering. But then let us now look at the other end of dependent origination, the first link, the very beginning of this 12-link formula. Because when we go back to the beginning, this is where we find the first cause. And if we can do something about this first cause, then the whole 12-link will unravel by themselves. So this first cause is often called avidya in the Pali language. Avidya means it's often translated as ignorance. But I think it's more appropriate maybe to say that it means a delusion, it means a misunderstanding of how reality works. And the main aspect of this delusion, this misunderstanding of reality, and this is interesting because it relates straight back again to the first factor here. One of the main aspects of this misunderstanding is to not understand what suffering is. This is one of the main problems. So because you don't understand suffering, because you can't see it, that is what is meant by this delusion to a large extent. So you can't see it. You don't actually realize what the problem is. And that's why, of course, the Buddha's teachings are so important. Because the Buddha then comes and says, well, there is a problem there. There is this thing called rebirth. There is the endless amount of potential suffering in life. So it gives you a chance to reflect on this thing that we, on this problem that we have. We can't see things clearly here. And this problem that we cannot see, that we can't understand, the suffering problem, it is basically the same as the problem of not understanding non-self, not understanding impermanence. These things just revolve around each other. They are different aspects of the same problem. It was interesting. You cannot end suffering because you don't understand it, right? And it makes good sense. Because in life, it's always like that. If we want to overcome a problem, we have to understand the problem, usually first of all. And only then, when we understand the problem, are we able to actually do something about it. Can we actually move in the right direction and eliminate this problem? And because we don't understand suffering, and this is the important thing, this is how dependent origination works, because you have an illusion that there is some happiness there which doesn't actually exist, that there is something to be had from this life in samsara or from existence in one way or another. It is precisely because of that illusion that you have craving for rebirth in the future, for all kind of experiences in life, all these kind of things. They come, that craving arises precisely because of the delusion that there's some happiness out there. Not only because of that, but also because of the idea that you think that you are in control, that you're in charge, and that you actually can make a difference in your life. You can make a difference for the experience of happiness rather than the experience of suffering here. So the point here is that because you don't understand the problem, because you think that there is happiness where in fact there is suffering, the craving arises, because craving then goes out there to try to get hold of that thing that you think is happiness out there. If you saw that there's no happiness to be had, if you saw that you are not really in charge, you can't really control the happiness and suffering anyway, at that moment you would let go of the craving. Because why crave for suffering? Why crave for something which actually is not nice? And it's obvious that at that point you would let go of the craving completely. So delusion, ignorance, is causing craving. And that craving in turn Craving, in a very simple way, craving is like projecting yourself into the future. Craving is always about the future, right? You desire something now, it's about some kind of future result you want to have. Whether it's craving for existence, or craving for sensual pleasures, or craving for anything, it's about the future. So it is a bit like projecting yourself into a future existence. And that is why, once you have the craving, you keep the cycle of rebirth going, because you're projecting yourself into the future. And when you keep the cycle of rebirth going, you also keep suffering going, because these two are aspects of one and the same thing. So ignorance, delusion, leads to craving. Craving perpetuates the idea of suffering, and basically endlessly like that. So that is a very brief idea of how dependent origination works. Now I want to focus a little bit now on the solution to dependent origination, because it's always nice to know that there is a way out of this. And of course, you can already probably guess what the way out is. Of course, the way out is, if the first problem is delusion or ignorance, then obviously we must get rid of that delusion and that ignorance and try to see things in the right way instead. So that is the solution to overcoming suffering, to overcoming, first of all, the ignorance itself. So how do we do that? And it says elsewhere in the sutta that the way to do this is, well, first of all, the sutta says that it's actually the five hindrances that prop up ignorance. As long as we have five hindrances in our mind, then ignorance is like propped up. Because five hindrances lead to confusion in the mind. We can't see things clearly. When you have a hindrance in your mind, you think that what is actually... To take sensual desire, for example. When you have a sensual desire, sometimes you go past the shop window, you see something beautiful, and on an impulse, because you think that it's very beautiful, you buy this thing from the shop, you take it back home, and afterwards you wonder, what on earth did I do that for? That was just a waste of money. Right? This happens to everybody, I'm sure. What is going on there? Why does that actually happen? And the reason why it happens is because at the time you're under the influence of craving and desire. When you're under the influence of craving and desire, your perception is warped. You don't see things as it actually is. What you're seeing is what you want to see. You're not actually seeing what is actually there. So desire warps your perception of the world around you. It is the same thing with, one of the obvious kind of desire which causes so much problem in the world is like infidelity in marriage, right? Because there's so many problems, and so often you do it, and afterwards you think that was a bad thing to do. But at the time, it seemed right. So while you're under the influence of the desire, it seems right. Afterwards, you know, when you have a clarity again in your mind, then you know it was a mistake. So desire warps your perception; it makes what is wrong look right. And with anger, I think it's even more obvious. If you are upset, you have a bad day, you're not feeling very good about yourself, and then you say something or do something to somebody, which at the time seems right, and afterwards you think, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Why is that? Because while you're angry, your mind is warped. It seems right, but only when your mind is clear afterwards again do you understand that it actually was a mistake. So my point here is simply to show that that five hindrances, the defilements of the mind, that distort our perception. It makes us look at the world in the way the world actually is not. It makes us see the world in a wrong way, not according to reality. And that is the problem. And of course, if you don't see the world according to reality, you are under the influence of avidya. You're not understanding things properly. So we have to get rid of the five hindrances. That is the path to actually to awakening. Now to understand how to get rid of the five hindrances, there is another kind of dependent origination. This is sometimes called transcendental dependent origination. It is called transcendental dependent origination because it leads to the transcendence, the overcoming of suffering. And this is not really dependent origination, but it's a causal sequence that works in the same way as dependent origination. It's a series of things that lead you stage by stage from the beginning, and the beginning is usually a virtue, until the last stage, which is vimutti, which is liberation. So let us look a little bit at this sequence, at least some of the factors in this sequence. So this sequence, sometimes it starts off with dukkha, and then it says that if you have suffering, it leads to faith. you know what it's like to suffer in life, and then you have to find a solution to suffering, right? That's why we're all here. That's why we're all Buddhists. There is a problem, we want to find a solution. You hear the Buddha's teaching, you think, gee, that is amazing. This is a solution to the problem. I found the solution to the problem of life. And that was, for me, it was a big eye-opener. When I became a Buddhist, I started practicing meditation. I had some good results in meditation, first of all. That was a very important part of my starting point as a Buddhist. But it was later on that I read about the Buddhist ideas, that I understood how powerful and how important these teachings actually are. It took a while to really for me to penetrate what is going on here. But I realized for the first time in my life that here is a teaching that tells you about suffering and happiness, to understand the difference between what is suffering and what is happiness. And I also knew this is what everybody wants. Everybody wants happiness in their life. Nobody wants any more suffering. Nobody wants to be more depressed or more sad or anything like that. It's impossible. We all want happiness in life. And here is a path that teaches us exactly that. Wow, this is amazing. Why, how can I not be a Buddhist? That would be madness not to be a Buddhist. This is, you know, this is what everybody's searching for. This is the answer to the meaning of life. This is basically what it is all about. And that is what changed me around. So that is what faith arises. Faith arises when you know that there is a problem. And then you come across a teaching that addresses that problem directly and says there is even a solution to this problem. So faith arises. And then once faith arises, then this whole thing starts to take off. But often, it's only one place, I think, in the suttas where this dependent, transcendental dependent arising starts off with faith. More commonly, it starts off with virtue. And then from virtue, it leads to this thing called pamuja, which is like gladness inside. Then it leads to piti. Piti is the rapture you can sometimes feel in the body when a meditation is going well. It's like a coarse feeling in the body. Beautiful feeling, but quite coarse. And then that leads to the pasada. You become calm and peaceful, which leads to a deep sense of happiness and enjoyment, which is called sukha, which then leads on to the samadhi, which then gets you to the yatha, bhuta, nyanadasana, the seeing things as they actually are. And that, of course, is what we want, what we require. That's what we want, right? We want to see things as they actually are, because then we know the problem. We understand what's going on. This is what we're searching for here. We're searching to make an end of ignorance, right? So if we see things as they actually are, it's the opposite of ignorance. So we're searching for the end of ignorance. So what does this sequence mean? Now, once we get to piti, the rapture in the body, the physical feeling of joy inside of you, there you are already talking about meditation. There you're talking about very peaceful states of meditation. Meditation is working very well. And I don't want to go too much into meditation today. Maybe a little bit afterwards. I want to focus on the things that come before meditation. So before piti, I said, is pamuja. So pamuja leads to piti. The pamuja is this gladness inside of you. That gladness inside of you comes from sila, from virtue. So virtue here is like the first factor that we have to focus on. And pamuja, the gladness in the mind, is the sense of liberation you have inside of you when you live a virtuous and good life. You feel a natural sense of joy inside of you, of happiness, of mindfulness, and all these kind of things. So what do we mean by virtue? And this is very important to understand. This is an important point, because unless you understand the meaning of virtue, then you will not really be able to practice the path fully. So virtue, of course, is, as you all know, is the practice of virtue in bodily conduct, to be kind through body, how we act in the body. That's a very important part. How we are kind in speech. You say kind things to each other, you avoid saying the bad things. Obvious, right? But the last one, and this is the one where most people struggle. And this is the one which actually, if you want to have success in a meditation, this is the one that really matters. And that is the virtue of the mind. It is about having kind thoughts. It's about having a sense of peace and compassion towards other beings. It's even having an idea of renunciation inside of you. This is the most important part of virtue. And to understand why this is so, and this is where the talk gets a little bit practical as well. To understand why this is so, then for a second, let us just reflect on how the suttas that describe the meditation practice, what they look like. Now, if you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, the Anapanasati Sutta is the Buddha's main instruction on mindfulness of breathing. in that sutta, the mindfulness of breathing starts off with a very short paragraph, and I think is a very important paragraph to understand. That paragraph says, he's talking to the monk, so it's addressed to the monk. It says, the monk goes to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut. So first of all, seclusion, right? You have to have some seclusion. So, you know, go on a retreat somewhere far away here where you get some seclusion for yourself. If you really want to go deep in meditation, the Buddha says, this is what you have to do. If you want to have success in mindfulness of breathing, you're going to have seclusion to some extent. First thing is that, then he says, you sit down. Okay? So, breathing meditation is about being seated. It's not about walking or standing or anything else. It's about sitting down. Sitting is the meditation posture number one. Number two meditation posture is walking here. But if you want to focus on the breath, sitting is the way to go. So you sit down and it says you put your legs crosswise. You cross your legs. What does that mean? And sometimes people say, oh, if you are going to meditate, you have to sit cross-legged. If you sit on a chair, you're not really meditating properly. But the point here is, and this is a passage I came across in the sutras quite recently, this is a passage where a nun says to the Buddha, she says, I can find no comfort, and she is ill. I can find no comfort unless I sit cross-legged. So the point is, and I think this is true even today in certain cultures, unless in those days, because they were used to sitting on the floor, because this was the standard posture, that you were used to sitting cross-legged, this was what was comfortable for them. So, if the sutta says you should sit down cross-legged, what it actually means, in my interpretation, is sit comfortably. Now that changes the equation quite a lot, right? So if you sit on a chair, it's fine. If you sit on a very big cushion, it's okay here. As long as you're comfortable, as long as you have a good time and you're enjoying yourself, that is what is important. So, sometimes you have to really reflect on these terms. It seems very obvious what sitting cross-legged means, but actually, it may not be as obvious as you think it is. Then it says, setting his body erect. So, in other words, you establish an erect posture. And of course, the purpose of that is that if you have an erect posture, then usually your mind becomes more clear, right? Because if you're slouching over, that's usually the sleeping posture. You start nodding here. And it's okay to nod. I'm not trying to say nodding is bad. It's fine to nod. But the mindfulness that comes, it comes usually from a straight posture. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we should force ourselves into a straight posture? No. Again, that's not what it means. What it means is that you should sit comfortably. If you force yourself to be strict with a straight back, but you're not really comfortable that way, you're not really ready for that, again, you're going to make life difficult for yourself. And I know, even people like Ajahn Brahm says he had a long day, he's tired. When he starts in meditation, even Ajahn Brahm, right? I mean, I don't know anybody who's a better meditator than Ajahn Brahm, to be quite honest with you. But even he starts back, leaning against the wall, sit nice comfortably, and just learn to relax, first of all. Just to allow everything to calm down and become peaceful, right? So even Ajahn Brahm does that sometimes. He's tired, and then he may fall asleep if he's very tired, which shows you it's okay to fall asleep in meditation. Or his mind becomes clear quite quickly. We should do the same thing. That is the example. So when you start your meditation, unless your mindfulness is very sharp straight away, which is very unlikely to happen, unless perhaps when you're on retreat, sit back and relax and allow yourself to become mindful gradually. Then when the mind becomes clear, it comes into the present moment and you feel that you have awareness with you right here, right now, then you almost feel natural for you to become straight. So straighten your body up when it is natural. And then you have the straightness of the body. Then it becomes easy. You can see here the whole thing is about ease, about being relaxed, about being comfortable, not about actually forcing yourself in an uncomfortable way here. And then the last thing, and this is really what I'm trying to get to, I'm just going through these other factors first of all. The very last thing the Buddha says, Satting parimukkang upatapetva. This means having established mindfulness in front of you. Having established mindfulness in front of you. So, without having established mindfulness, you cannot do anapanasati. You cannot do breath meditation without being mindful, first of all. Very, very, very important. And yet, very few people think about this. Usually they sit down and start watching the breath straight away or something. But they haven't really checked out whether mindfulness is there, first of all. So what is that mindfulness that we need to establish? It's just the ability to be basically in the present moment, to be in the here and now, not sort of going off all over the place, and being quite clear inside your head, not having to being too confused or being too restless, having a sense of clarity and present moment awareness. That's what it is. And that in itself is not easy. It's difficult, but it's not difficult, it's just that we have conditioned ourselves in such a way that it doesn't come naturally, right? That's what I mean. It's not as difficult, it's just that it doesn't come naturally here. So we have to recondition ourselves. So don't try to do things like watching your breath or doing the Satipatthana practices. All of these things require mindfulness, first of all, before you can do it. So wait till mindfulness is established. In the meantime, you have to do other things to get mindfulness there. It is so important. And unless you do that, you're not going to overcome the hindrances. And if you can't overcome the hindrances, you're not going to see things as they actually are and overcome the problem which is suffering here. So these are, I've been talking about these things in recent days when I went to Malaysia because we were doing some sutta studies, a sutta weekend. And when you read the sutta, sometimes you think, wow, it's all there. When you read carefully enough, it's all there. You just have to read the word of the Buddha again and again and again. It actually is there. And then you draw it out and you fit it together and it becomes very beautiful. So how then, if mindfulness isn't there, what do you do? Do you use an act of will to establish mindfulness? Do you think that's the right way? Okay, mindful. I'm going to clench my teeth and, you know, whatever. And you can establish some mindfulness by an act of will. It's true. You can do that. And this is why sometimes in certain meditation courses, you know, for example, some techniques is to walk slowly, or it is to count the breath or whatever. Now, all these things, walking slowly or counting the breath or whatever, or even just forcing your mind on the breath, all of these things are using willpower to be able to focus on the breath. Because walking slowly is unnatural. So if it is unnatural, then you're using some degree of force on that walking posture. And that is fine. A little bit of force, tiny little bit is okay. But most of the time we use far, far too much force. And that is the problem. So most people in the world think that it's through force that we establish mindfulness. But the Buddha said it's actually not through force. In the Satipatthana Sutta, just after he said having established mindfulness, he says, breathing in, he is mindful. Breathing out, he is mindful. And there's a small little word there, which is eva, which is added in. Eva is translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi and Dhanamoli as ever, ever mindful. And that's the wrong translation in this context. It's wrong, because ever mindful means that you have continuous mindfulness all the time. At least I think it's wrong. I should say I think it's wrong, because it's dangerous to make two an absolute statement. In my opinion, it's wrong. Because ever mindful means you're mindful all the time. And this is the very beginning stage of meditation. You're not mindful all the time. There's another meaning to eva. It means like only or simply. Just mindful. Just mindful means just awareness. No willpower, no force. Just awareness, just by itself. So there you are. Just awareness, no willpower. So that is really the right way to establish mindfulness. It really doesn't say anything much about how to do it. But all it says is that using willpower is not going to work in the long run. A little bit of willpower, maybe to begin with, but be very careful. Because usually it leads to headaches, leads to all these kind of problems that people have in the meditation practice. So what do we need to do then if we can't use willpower and we're not mindful? How do we get mindfulness? Okay, there's two things that you have to do to become mindful. The first thing, if you are already, let's say, on a retreat set situation or a daily life, is just to allow yourself to relax. And when you allow yourself to relax and you think about things in the right way with a bit of metta and compassion and peace, and you're able to tune into the peace, to remind yourself of the peace, maybe think of a peaceful moment in the past, then you can allow yourself to some extent to find that peace in the present moment. And by doing that, you find the mindfulness also in the present moment. Right? So this is the first way. So if you already are meditating, if you're already on the retreat, that's what you have to do. But the reality is that that is only going to go so far. It's only going to go so far because what really is going to make the difference is how you have practiced in the rest of your life. So, if you have practiced rightly in the rest of your life, then it is going to be quite easy on retreat. If you have practiced wrongly in the rest of your life, then it's going to be very hard regardless of what you do. It's not about what you do, it's about how you have prepared yourself prior to the retreat. You can see now how important it is to integrate daily life and retreats. These are not separate things. They always have to go hand in hand. So what then is the main thing that we have to integrate into our daily life? We already know that we have to keep the five precepts. We know that we have to be kind in speech and kind in body. But the most important thing here is the mind factor, the purification of the mind. This is what ultimately is going to lead you to mindfulness. Without that purification of mind, it is impossible that it can lead to mindfulness. And you see this in the suttas in many, many places. Once you have the purity of mind, the Buddha says, at that point, the mindfulness comes, the joy comes, the energy comes, everything comes at that point. And it's very fascinating. The Buddha then talks about how he established mindfulness himself prior to his awakening here. And again, when you read the sutta, you have to be very careful because it says there, he is ardent. The translation in the English as it is now is diligent, ardent, and resolute is the English translation. Now these Pali words can be translated in many ways. I don't really like the word diligent. I think heedful I prefer. Heedful to me has a nicer connotation. Heedful means like careful, right? Using wisdom, not sort of being over rash, trying to think about things carefully. Huh? And ardent is more like energetic inside. And resolute is probably okay. You're determined, you're going to overcome it. But don't think that these words mean willpower. It sounds like willpower, but if you look at this particular sutta I'm talking about, this is known as the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. The Buddha talks about his own striving for awakening. What he says that these words actually mean, what they mean is wisdom. That's what he says. And what he says is that, what he does in here, he says that when the thought of sensual desire or ill will arose in me, first of all, you notice that the Buddha has sensual desire and ill will, which is in one sense, it's quite nice because it means that the Buddha is an example for us. He has the same problems that we have. But what he then does is interesting. When these things arose, I reflected, sensual desire, ill will, leads to my own affliction, to my own pain. It leads to the pain of others. It leads to the pain of both. It leads to the ceasing of wisdom, panya nirodhika. It leads to the affliction of the mind, internal harm inside you. It feels bad inside of you. And it leads away from nirvana. This is what it says. Now these things are wisdom contemplations. This is wisdom. All the Buddha had to do was to remind himself, this leads to my own pain. And then when he thinks like that, the thought of sensual desire, the thought of ill will disappears straight away. That's the power. That's the power of a Buddha, right? He obviously was very wise. That's why he was able to break through to awakening without a teacher. We have teachers. It's difficult enough with a teacher. He did it without a teacher. So obviously, very, very wise person. But that is the way you do it. And so what you have to do to be able to improve your mindfulness is to remind yourself in daily life that this anger is bad for me. It's actually no good. It's going to lead to suffering in the future. Why is that? Because right now it's painful, because I'm eventually going to do something stupid if I'm angry. Everybody does stupid things eventually when they're angry. It's impossible to control yourself all the time. We all know that. If we are not careful and we do bad things, we create bad karma for ourselves. And the people around us suffer as well. So if you have a sense of compassion, they suffer. And it leads away. It destroys wisdom. How powerful. Don't we all want to be wise? Isn't wisdom one of those wonderful qualities we all want to cultivate? Of course it is. It destroys wisdom. It's destructive of wisdom because you can't see clearly anymore. So reflect on these things. A large part of the Buddha's teachings, which often is underestimated, is the importance of reflection, wise reflection, to understand why these things are a real problem. If you understand in your heart why anger is a real problem, then you will abandon it with ease. It will just disappear just like that. So use the wisdom. Use the wisdom power, like Ajahn Brahm likes to say. And for me, this is very nice, because Ajahn Brahm always talks about wisdom power. And here, the Buddha is essentially saying exactly the same thing. It's wisdom that hinders us, or stops, so helps us in overcoming the defilements of the mind. Very, very powerful and very important to understand. Not willpower, but wisdom. Wisdom and wisdom. And this then, so you use your wisdom in daily life, even whenever you can, to overcome the negative states. And in particular, I think sometimes in lay life, it's very hard to overcome all the desires. So much advertisement and things in life which always sort of, you know, tries to trap you to buy something or do something which maybe you don't even want to know or do. But do something with the anger, because the anger is the biggest problem. That is the issue which really is problematic. So do something with that, first of all, and also with the coarsest form of desires, you know, the things which really cause suffering and problems. If you can do that, then you're on the right track. And then you are building up your mindfulness. And then, when you have mindfulness, then comes the gladness I was talking about before. So this is how sila, virtue, leads to the gladness. When you have mindfulness, you feel a sense of energy inside of you. You feel a gladness inside of you. Everything is coming together. And then you are ready for meditation practice. Then when you sit down, then when you watch the breath, you have the power of the mind to watch the breath. Why is it that mindfulness helps you watch the breath? Because mindfulness in the suttas is a power, it's a bala, it's a faculty, an indriya. A faculty and a power means that the mind, you now have the ability to control the mind. The mind is under control. It's no longer running here, running there, out of control, in the caught up by desires and aversions. You are, suddenly you feel in charge. Okay, ultimately you're not really in charge after all, because there may be nobody in there. But you certainly feel in charge for the first time in your life. You feel you're not, you know, driven by all these other things. What a powerful feeling that is. And once you have that feeling, then when you direct your mind to the breath, it stays with the breath, because you have the power to direct the mind. You have a control over the mind. So now you can stay with the breath. And that is why mindfulness is required, because it gives you the ability to control the mind. And then, when you start your meditation practice, then the piti comes, right? Remember what I said? Virtue, sila, leads to pamuja. Pamuja leads to piti. Piti leads to pasaddhi, the tranquility. The tranquility leads to sukha, the deep sense of happiness, which then leads to samadhi. So then the meditation comes off. And all these other factors that lead up to samadhi, this shows you the process of what happens in meditation. The process is you feel the piti inside of you. This bubbling feeling, very, very nice feeling when you get it, nice feeling inside of you, which then, when you keep practicing that, leads to pasaddhi, calm, tranquility, the ease of the body, which then, when you practice it, leads to a delectable, nice happiness, which then leads to samadhi, which then leads to seeing things as they actually are. And for the first time in your life, you are really undermining ignorance, really undermining delusion, because you see things for what they actually are. And if you keep doing that, if you keep undermining that ignorance, there comes the day when it stops and is destroyed completely. And then you have actually attained the ending of suffering. But the reason I have spent so much time talking about this mindfulness and meditation is because this is really the practical aspect of what we can do to end dependent origination. This is what we should be doing. Once you understand that, once you understand what it is that destroys avijja at the beginning, then the whole chain starts to disappear. As I said before, once avijja is gone, you are no longer under the delusion that there is anything to crave for. Also, you understand you cannot be in control anyway. If you can't control, why crave? So craving disappears. As soon as craving disappears, there's nothing more that projects you into the future, into a new life. Because nothing projects you into the future, into a new life, there's no rebirth. And that is the end of suffering. It all starts with how we practice in daily life. It all starts with things like establishing mindfulness. Fairly simple things, but sometimes takes a lot of dedication to work. So that is the path. Don't ever think that the path is difficult. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. If you think the path of practice is difficult, you're going to discourage yourself and you won't be able to do it. It's more like it just takes determination. It takes that understanding, that willingness to do it. If you have the willingness to do it, you will succeed. That is the promise of the Buddha. Okay, so enough. I'm speaking for far too long probably, but I apologize for that. It's just that I've been talking about mindfulness and how to establish meditation over the last few days. And I find it so inspiring when I read about these things. And when you find something inspiring, you want to talk about that because that's what inspires you. You don't want to, you know, talk about other stuff. And that's the problem sometimes. That's why I had to go into that. So please, I apologize if I didn't talk enough about dependent origination. But that was my where my mind was sort of heading. And this is, after all, about dependent origination, because it is just another process which also arises dependently. So shall we do some Q&A, Henry? Yeah,
thank you, Ajahn, for sharing more like linking dependent origination to the other practices. And his inspiration for the last few days, obviously a bit contagious. Yeah, linking it all to the practice of meditation and mindfulness. Thank you very much, Ajahn. Okay, is there any other question that you all may have that you'd like to ask Ajahn? Or any topic that may revolve around mindfulness, meditation? Thank you.
Okay.
Ajahn, just now you mentioned that if you are meditating and you have difficulty staying calm, you suggested maybe we should think of something peaceful and then try to calm the body down. Can you give us an example, and like how long should we try to think of something before? Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. It's not so, you don't have to think very long. What you have to do is just find the right object. So very often, one way of doing that is simply to remember a time in your life when you were very peaceful, when you had success in a meditation, and try to sort of link your mind onto that experience you had before. And sometimes it's like you can make a connection with that experience. When you make the connection, you find yourself going in the same direction. It will work sometimes, other times it won't work. So if it doesn't work, then you just have to, you know, allow yourself naturally to become peaceful. Another way of doing it is simply, sometimes when you sit in a group like this, there is a certain power in a group. There's a certain strength to a lot of people sitting quietly together. It feels more peaceful somehow when many people sit quietly together. So that is why, before you get to the point where you have to go off into the forest by yourself, which can take a while, before that point, it can be quite nice to sit together in a group. So come together in a group, sit down together, have a teacher if you want. One of the great services that we provide now at the BSWA in Perth is that we provide live streaming of meditation directly. So on Saturday at 3 p.m., the time in Singapore is the same as in Perth, so it makes it quite easy. And Saturday at 3 p.m., there's live streaming. So if you want a teacher, you can then stream that onto your screen here or whatever, directly, and then you have a teacher as well. It's really up to you how you want to do it, but at least that's one possibility for you. So that is another way of then giving rise to a sense of peace, feeling the peace of the group together. So sometimes you have some sort of perception inside of you that gives rise to these things. Happy with that? Excuse me. Please ask questions on any subject you like. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's on Buddhism, it's helpful. But anything within Buddhism is actually okay, if you wish.
Venerable Ajahn, according to the traditional explanation of this dependent origination, they talk about three lifespan covering these 12 links. There is also another version which talks about referring to these three lives, but referring to a moment-to-moment understanding of the phenomena arising in a person. So, with the single life and the three life explanation, how do we reconcile what actually should be the teaching?
Sure. Yeah, good question. And it's actually good that you ask this question, because sometimes I could talk about these things and nobody might be interested. But because you ask about it, it's good, because then we know that people are interested. So thank you for that question. And the place that idea comes from, the momentary-to-moment idea comes from, it comes from the Abhidhamma. That's where it's found first. It's in a part of the Abhidhamma called the Vibhanga, which is one book of the Abhidhamma. Now, the important thing to understand here is that this Vibhanga explains the dependent origination in two ways. First, it explains it in an ordinary way, three lifetimes, and then it explains it in a second way, which is moment-to-moment. Now, the first way, it calls the method of the suttas. The second way, it calls the method of the Abhidhamma. So if you want to know what the sutta said, you have to look at the method of the suttas. The method of the suttas is three lifetime. That's what it says. So it is very clear that when you read the suttas, it always refers to three lifetime. Now, if you go into the suttas in great detail, and you see what it has to say about dependent origination, this takes quite a bit of research sometimes and understanding. But there are very clear instances where it must very obviously, means three lifetimes. For example, the word birth. Now, the word birth is explained as the coming into existence, the appearing of the five khandhas, the acquisition of the faculties, all these kind of things. In other words, ordinary birth, not some kind of momentary arising. Aging is said to be the wrinkling of the skin, the graying of the hair, the breaking of the teeth, the blotching of the limbs, walking with a walking stick, etc. It doesn't mean some kind of metaphorical aging. It means the real thing. Death is the breaking up of the body. These definitions are so clear that how anybody could argue that this actually means a momentary thing is only because of the Abhidhamma. And that is why it is so important to understand that the Abhidhamma divides it into two aspects. One is the method of the Abhidhamma, another is the method of the suttas. And the method of the suttas is always three lifetimes. That's the one you want to go for, because the suttas are the word of the Buddha. The Abhidhamma is the word of somebody else. We don't know who it was. Because we don't know who it was, it's much better to rely on the word of the Buddha. Are you happy with that answer?
Venerable Achan, you mentioned about the sutta method and the Abhidhamma method. However, these 12 links of dependent origination, starting with ignorance and ending with suffering. According to the traditional method, the name ignorance and sankhara, mental formation, as belonging to the past, and putting suffering as well as the last two ring, that means the birth and suffering, as the future. Now, according to certain suttas in the Samyutta, the Buddha mentioned that we shouldn't be concerned with the past. Neither should we be concerned with the future. One is gone and dead. One hasn't come. So, to those who explain dependent origination within this life, while we are alive, we don't go back to the past. So, ignorance is something, if we say it belongs to the past, then, how do we reconcile the fact that at any moment we can be ignorant, we can be deluded, and that is in the present. So why should ignorance be in the past?
Okay, first of all, you have to be very careful. When you read a passage like that, don't be concerned about the past, don't be concerned about the future. You have to read the context very, very carefully. I think I know the passage you're referring to, and this is a passage about somebody who is talking about seeing future, you know, understanding future lives through paranormal phenomena. It was a wanderer. Somebody wasn't even a Buddhist. Somebody was concerned with all the kind of wrong ideas. And then the Buddha says to him, well, don't worry about these things, you know. You can understand things right now in the present moment. That's what he's saying. And that is because I think that's the sutta I'm referring to, because I've heard this sutta, this kind of quote before. I've read this before. In certain works. Maybe you're referring to something else, but it doesn't matter here. The point is that the dependent origination, the causality, how the actual thing works, the idea that craving leads to rebirth, that can be seen in the present moment. The causal connection can be understood in the present moment. So it's actually, you can actually know right here and now, not right now, without seeing past lives, without seeing future lives. You can understand the principle, because the principle is actually visible in the moment. So it's the principle you're looking for here. And once you understand the principle, you can see that craving must lead to rebirth in a future life without seeing the future, without seeing the past. You have seen the principle of how these things work. Now, this is not necessarily easy to understand how that can be, but that is, in a sense, the promise of stream entry on the path. And remember that even the Arahant, when the Arahant comes to his final awakening, he is said to know that there is no more rebirth in the future, right? So there is a knowledge there about something. He may never have recalled a past life. He may never have seen the future in any way. And yet he knows that because, again, he has seen the causality that works between these factors. And by understanding that causality thoroughly, he knows there cannot be such a thing as a rebirth in the future. And this is the problem with the Dhamma. The problem with the Dhamma is that it actually is very profound. So what you are, you know, what people sometimes say, you know, you have to know the past, the future, to see this all links. Actually, it isn't quite like that. It's about understanding a principle, and that can be understood in the present moment. Is that helpful? Huh? Yeah? Think about it a little bit, and then when I come back next time, you can ask again, and we can see if we can go any further in this debate, if you like. Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah. So, anybody else? Please don't, you don't have to ask very difficult questions. You can ask very simple questions as well. That's perfectly okay. Even stupid questions are acceptable in this audience. So anything you like.
Good evening, Ajahn Brahmani. Regarding this dependent origination topic, I heard that you were saying from mindfulness, the meditation technique, to tranquility and then to samadhi. So I was just reading something on the seven factors of enlightenment. So I just like to link back to that. Can you briefly go through, like I do understand each of the factors, but how does mindfulness link to investigation of the Dhamma? And does this steps also should be applied when we meditate? That means, because since this will lead to enlightenment, so is that the steps that we should follow to during meditation?
Okay. Yes, the seven factors of enlightenment are very similar to what I was talking about now. It's the same kind of sequence. And it is a sequence that is happening in your mind as you do meditation practice. It's not something that you pursue deliberately. It's what happens while you meditate. So if you do mindfulness of breathing, these states happen in sequence, just like the states I was talking about before. Now, the only difference is that when we're talking about the seven factors of enlightenment, we're talking about a fairly high state where you have abandoned the five hindrances completely, absolutely. So that is why the seven factors start off with mindfulness. It's the very first factor. So it's already assumed that mindfulness is in place, right? It has already been practiced, it's in place. Factor number two, investigation of dhammas, investigation of qualities, mental qualities. This is about knowing what inside of you is wholesome, what is unwholesome, understanding what is blameworthy and blameless, what are good states, what are bad states. In other words, being able to distinguish between the things that lead towards enlightenment and awakening and the things that take you away from awakening and mindfulness and all the other good qualities. And that is very important, because unless you fully understand the whole range of bad states and the whole range of good states, you won't be able to overcome these things. Ordinary ordinarily, when the mindfulness is weak and not so strong, you know, most times during the day or during life, we see defilements only to a certain extent. You see the coarser ones because they are very obvious in the mind. It's very obvious to see when you get very angry. Anybody can do that. But it's ability to see the tiny little things, the tiny, tiny irritation, the minute restlessness, the sloth and torpor, which is so little that you don't even know it's there. The desire, which is very, very small, just, you know, very tiny sensual desire, which is concerned maybe with moving your body or wanting to hear something, very, very slight things. And these are the things you start to understand at this point with the seven factors of enlightenment. In other words, once mindfulness is established, you can understand the very, very refined aspects of the hindrances and of the defilements in the mind. So that's why investigation of dhammas comes there. So this is not about understanding the coarse things, but the refined things. So mindfulness helps you then to overcome the remaining defilements in your meditation practice, because you understand what they are. And this is something you see throughout the suttas in many places, that this is the purpose of mindfulness, is to twofold, to help you overcome the last remnant of the hindrances, and then to unify the mind towards samadhi. And then, once you have understood the defilements completely, what they are, only then can you overcome them, right? Then once they overcome, the virya, the energy arises in the mind, because you have abandoned all the defilements. That's what I was saying before. When the defilements are abandoned, the natural state in the mind is energetic, it's beautiful, it's happy. And that energy is very similar to what we call pamudra before, the gladness in the mind. And from that energy comes the piti. Right? This is the fourth factor, the fourth bhojanga. From that piti comes the pasaddi bhojanga, the calm. You see, these are the factors almost exactly the same we were talking about before, right? Piti, pasaddi, and then you have the samadhi, right? Is that right? Yeah, the samadhi. Samadhi comes from the pasaddi, and then you have the equanimity after that. So it is essentially quite right. It's basically exactly the same thing that we were talking about before. So you can look at it like that. The beginning part is to make sure you are established in mindfulness. That mindfulness helps you to overcome defilements completely. And then the process happens all by itself, and it goes up towards samadhi. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So...
Thank you, Ajahn, for the lesson. I have two separate questions. The first one is that how do you measure the success of your meditation, and how do you train for that success? For example, a 42-kilometer marathon, how do you train for it? And my second question, can I take it at the same time?
Can I answer that one first? Sure. Otherwise, I forget the second one. Okay. So, how do you measure success in meditation, right? And how do you train for that? So, two questions already here. So, have a third one later on. So, how do you measure success in meditation? How do you measure success in spiritual life at all? How do you measure success in anything here? And the Buddha gave a very simple advice. There's another advice that I've been talking about over the past few days. A very simple advice to always to decide whether you're going in the right direction, doing the right thing here. And that simple advice is very simply that if you are increasing in good states, declining in bad states, then you are on the right track. Your meditation is working. That is the kind of the clue to everything in life. If you're increasing in good states, declining in bad states, then you're going in the right direction. That is true for an individual meditation session. If you sit down to meditate and you find that you're becoming more and more angry, more and more negative because you have so much pain in the body or whatever, then you're going the wrong way. Stop straight away. Ask yourself, what am I doing wrong here? Or you're getting more and more sloth and torpor. Actually, sloth and torpor is not so bad because sometimes you have to go through that stage. But if you're getting more and more angry and more desire, then definitely you're going in the wrong way here. So that is true for an individual meditation session. But it's even more true for life in general. So you should look on your life. What has been happening over the past few months? What is happening over the last year? And if you see that you are improving in good states, you're getting more mindful, you're becoming more kind-hearted, you're becoming more peaceful as a person, you're having more compassion for people around you. All these beautiful things that we're trying to develop on the spiritual path are increasing inside of you. You know you're doing the right thing here. If that is not happening, then you have to ask yourself, where am I going wrong here? So it's as simple as that. And it is a thing that I use in my monastic life as well. I always ask myself, should I stay at Bodhidharma Monastery? Should I have a different teacher? This is the criteria I use always for any decision I have to make in life. Only that criteria. And the Buddha said it's the only criteria we need. Why? Because if you are improving in wholesome states, you are moving in the right direction. You're moving towards Nibbana. If you're not improving in wholesome states, you're not going anywhere. It doesn't matter how many hours you're sitting on the cushion. It's about whether you are improving. That is the important thing here. So it's a very, very useful guide. And I really encourage you to use this guideline in your daily life, in your take a long-term view of these things. And then you have to ask yourself, why isn't it working? And this is what the training you're talking about comes in. And a very large part of that training is you have to purify your mind. Buddhism is a path of purification, right? So if it isn't working, probably you have to do something with your mind, to change your outlook, to do something, look at things in a different way. And one of the best ways of training that mind is to make sure that you do some metta meditation. People often focus a lot on samatha meditation, on vipassana, and you hear these things all the time, but to even be able to do samatha vipassana, you have to have purity of mind, first of all. That is helped enormously by metta. So by all, I recommend everybody to do metta meditation because it helps your purity, it helps you moving in the right direction. So supply metta into your meditation. Make that part of your daily practice or your weekly practice or whatever you have. I don't know how you do your practice, but do a few minutes of metta every day if you can. It's so powerful and so useful. And it changes the way you look at the world. It changes the way you look at yourself. It changes the way you look at people around you. And it becomes a very powerful and beautiful things after a while. So please do that. And I think this is one of the problems in kind of modern meditation circles. They often assume a very high level for people. Okay, go in and do vipassana practice, do samatha practice, get the jhanas. But I mean, most people are not ready for getting the jhanas. You know, you're almost enlightened when you get to the jhanas, for goodness sake. These are extremely profound things. So start where you're at. Do the things. Put in the causes that will give rise to those results in the future. Metta, very, very important. Look at your daily life. So how can you have metta in your meditation? It depends in a large part on how much metta you have to the people around you in daily life. Ask yourself if you can be kinder to the people around you. Ask yourself if you can say some. Think just about your wife. Are you married? Yeah, okay, there you are. So you have a wife, right? So sometimes when we live together with people for too long, we take them for granted. Think, what can I say to my wife? One nice thing to my wife every day. Something small, doesn't have to be much, right? Say that to your wife. And you will find that even if your wife couldn't, you know, doesn't respond, she probably will respond, but even, is she sitting behind there, is she? Okay. Okay. But even if she doesn't respond, it doesn't matter, because you will feel good for saying something nice every day. A small thing, yeah. And even if you have to sort of, think about it for a while to find something nice to say, take that time to think about something nice. Do it to your co-workers. Do it to somebody random on the street. Say something nice. Do something good. And that is how you, even if it doesn't come naturally, do it nonetheless, because you're learning to metta in action. When you have metta in action, afterwards the metta in meditation comes as well. So metta in action first, then metta in meditation, then samatha vipassana. Or then mindfulness rather, then samatha vipassana, and this whole thing starts to take off. Okay?
So yeah, thank you very much. the side question is, that's not related to, but was related to a comment you mentioned about the mind being born into animal and being constrained. A side question is that if you observe people with problems, for example, autism or dyslexia or what have you, is it the same situation? They are just being put into a vessel that is not as perfect or as normal. Is that a correct assumption?
I think very often it is. It's hard to say anything with absolute certainty, but I think very often it is. Sometimes you have people going schizophrenic. You have people with Alzheimer's. Ajahn Brahm's mother passed away recently, which you may have heard about. And Ajahn said, great, she's passed away. She got rid of that body which was useless. So he was very happy when she passed away. And which is very nice. It shows you how you're supposed to react when somebody passes away, you know. No need for sadness, they're moving on there. And Alzheimer's is just that. It's you're trapped in the brain, which is completely deteriorated, completely non-functioning. Once it's released, you're free from that. There's a very interesting book I was reading a while ago called Irreducible Mind, it's called. It's a rather strange title. It's called Irreducible Mind. And this book is about all these phenomena that people cannot explain in the world. And then they're sort of making the case that we need a new way of looking at the mind. Because these are scientists, these are not just ordinary people. Scientists, we need a new way of understanding the mind because all these phenomena cannot be explained by our current way of looking at the world. And one of the things that we're talking about there were people with Alzheimer's here. And they were saying that there have been many, many cases around the world, a certain percent, maybe 1% of all Alzheimer's people, if you add them up, is a large, large number of people, who, what happens to them is that just before they are about to die, you know, seconds before, they suddenly become very clear. And for the first time in years sometimes, they recognize all the people around them, and they can have a conversation with the people around them. Now that, how you can't explain that? If you think that the brain is everything there is, it's inexplicable. The only way you can explain that is from a Buddhist idea that there is a point when the mind is starting to release from the physical body. And because it's a releasing from the physical body, just before it releases completely, the mind is liberated from the constraints of the brain. Because it's liberated from the constraints of the brain, it's able to think clearly again, back to where it was. Very powerful evidence, and these people were saying it cannot be explained by the idea that the mind is a byproduct of the brain. So I think in the coming years we will see more of this kind of research, and we'll see more ideas about the fact that there is something more going on here. It's not as simple as just saying that the mind is part of the brain. So the idea of rebirth is a possibility. So yes, and it's true in cases of people going crazy, schizophrenia, maybe even severe depression, all these kind of things may be a result of the brain trapping them. They are trapped by the brain. The mind is like filtered through a brain which is defective. And as you say, autism, for example, might be one of those things. But sometimes it's hard to know exactly, you know, when it is a mind thing and when it is a physical defect. But in very many cases, I think you're quite right, it is a physical defect.
So it's quite sad then, because it just means that there might not be any cure until the end of life, or maybe.
There might not be, but maybe there is. Maybe they can come up with a cure as well. So we can treat the brain, and maybe brain transplant is one possibility. You know, no, I don't know if they will ever do that, but sometimes it is a bit sad, and you just have to wait sometimes. It's quite right. Okay, Henry, and should we take some more questions? Or?
I think we're about there, unless somebody has a very pressing question that needs to be asked. you have covered so much this evening, Ajahn. I think a lot of us must go back and reflect on some of them. Been very useful, the linkages, and it's not just the suttas that you are regurgitating, but really linking it to make it all work. Thank you very much. If there's none, then we will call it a night.